So close.
I take no pleasure in delivering news that you don't want to hear, but I do take pleasure in helping kickstart your life going forward. And you're so blessed to have.
Hi, Echo.
There we go. I love watching the meetings because I'm a nerd. I actually watch them. I made it through 3 hours of the Tuesday meeting. I didn't quite make it all the way to the end.
It was a long meeting.
Yeah, it was intense. But I love, you know, people forgetting to unmute and constantly having to be reminded.
Yeah.
It's hilarious. You did such a good job.
Oh, thank you.
So I'm humbled by the mass of detail you have in your head. It's truly impressive.
Thank you.
You know, I mean, I taught at SOU for a really long, long time. And when I would be doing advising appointments with students, I would have all of these like masses of details that I would try to explain to them because they were trying to get their schedules and deal with problems. And I was trying to help them fix them. And they would look at me like deer in headlights frequently. And I have the same experience now going, oh my God, Linda knows all this stuff, about so many things. So it's really fascinating.
Thank you.
So I'm learning a lot. I like that.
Yeah. Well, I'm fortunate that I've done this for a while now. It's endless, you know, it's huge.
Yeah.
And it's changing all the time and there's new things. And I think I'm really fortunate as a housing person to be in the planning department.
Mm-hmm.
Because I did not know anything about planning before I came to the city. Nothing.
Yeah.
So that's been a whole huge learning curve. And I actually had met you at SOU a long time ago. I wasn't a student. I was in the women's studies program. I had a women's studies minor, and I went to Barbara Winkler's what was it? Tenure party she had.
Okay.
And I think I met
you. You're where she died.
I am. I couldn't believe it.
I didn't know. Most of us didn't know what was really going on with her until we went to her memorial service. And Gregory, her husband, talked. And Barbara had been ill for a number of years and finally got to the point roughly 2013 or so, where she just really couldn't work anymore. And it turned out she had like a really long-term chronic, like decades-long illness issues that she just didn't share with people. She was afraid of being stigmatized.
Aww.
And I sort of understood that now in retrospect. But it explained so much about what had been going on with her for the last few years that she was working. So it was really kind of sad, actually. But, you know, a lot of things that she wanted to happen with that program have now happened.
Oh, really?
And if she were still alive, she would be really happy because now it's now gender, sexuality, and women's studies. So it's open across the whole spectrum of gender. And it's slated to be its own proper actual major, not just a minor, starting in the fall, assuming SOU still exists, which is a little scary. But yeah, she'd be really thrilled about that. I just wish she was here to see it.
Yeah. I after I graduated, because I did have a minor in women's studies and I had gone, you know, I'd been in like every women's studies class that they offered, because that's what you had to do if you wanted to get a minor. And so I was always with her. And then at the end, we had to do a practicum and it was just four of us and her. We'd meet once a week in that building across the street and just talk and hang out. And so I felt like I really got to know her over the, years of being with her and spending so much time with her. But then, you know, you go out into the world and do all the other things, and I just lost touch. I used to see Dr. Gary Miller all the time too, because I have a history degree and so I spent all history people. We just stayed in the same building all the time and didn't see anybody. And Karen Sunderson, because I also had a minor in Latin American studies. And so I spent tons of time with her and Dr. Mullen too. And,
oh yeah.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
And so I did keep up a little bit with Dr. Mullen and Dr. Miller over the years. And so I knew that Dr. Mullen died. And we have some mutual friends. So after I graduated, I got a job at the Job Council working for, as an AmeriCorps person, working for a guy named Larry Slessler, who's my boss. And he was best friends. I actually went to college with Jay, high school and college with Jay Mullen. And and my husband is a teacher, a history teacher. And so he used to have Jay come to his classes. So I still got to keep up with them. And it's interesting because I don't know why I knew Barbara died, but I feel like somebody sent me an email about it. And I just was, I had no idea she was even not well, because she just was such an amazing person. I'd never met anyone like her.
Yeah, she's totally committed to students, really to the point, frankly, I think, of neglecting herself. So it was the last couple of years of her work at SOU that were really difficult. She was frequently just physically unwell, and emotionally it was even more difficult than the physical illness. So it was just really kind of a sad story. And in hindsight, knowing that she didn't tell us more of the whole story. As far as I know, I don't know if her husband stayed in the area. Her daughter graduated at Oregon State, I think. And I'm not quite sure where she's ended up. But it was, I was at a lot of those women's studies council meetings, all that good stuff. Hi, Rich.
I'm going to run out. I wanted to get this meeting going so you guys could pop in, but I'm going to run out for just a second. Okay. I'm going to be right back.
Okay, very good. Hi, Rich. Are you mic'd? Are you muted?
I think so. Do you hear it? Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
Well, the council meeting on Tuesday was extremely interesting.
Yeah, I've had some disappointing parts for me. But
I missed the last 30 minutes about the fire chief stuff.
Well, that was really kind of disappointing. But when they took it off the, Julie took it off the consent agenda, which was really inappropriate. I don't see how they could make a major decision like that. And what you put on the consent agenda is supposed to have something like a consensus, and they obviously knew it didn't have a consensus.
Yeah.
And so if it would have been on the agenda and people would have recognized it was on the agenda and you had a ability to testify or be part of that discussion, and learn what it was about, it would have been interesting. But that was kind of disappointing. But the rest was all right.
Well, I'm interested in what will actually end up happening with that proposed big development. You know, because both you and I live on this end of town. You're on Otis, is that right?
I'm on Ohio. I'm real close to y'all.
Okay, because I'm right on Glen. So, and I used to live on that very tail end of North Main 15 years ago. So I'm concerned about egress and ingress onto that particular parcel.
Right.
So maybe there's a way to make that work. And then that was the weird thing about, there was like an email from somebody, and then the applicant, whatever his name is, had this thing about he was going to ask the city to do bonds to help fund it, if I understood. But there wasn't anything in the packet about that.
Well, I didn't stay for that whole section. So
okay.
Did they bring it in from the, I assumed they were going to vote to annex it.
There was this two-step process of like the our part about affordable housing that had to get approved. That update had to get approved.
Right.
In order to do any action, to do any action on the annexation for that other property. So it's sort of like things had to get coordinated, but there's no actual plan yet for how to develop that parcel.
Why don't we ask Linda? Because she's going to know the inside scoop.
Yeah. Right.
So why don't we got about 4 minutes to go, but on this topic, it could go into the council debrief.
Yeah.
On the agenda.
Good.
And then if everybody's here when we get started, then we'll, so we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So we have a quorum, right?
Yeah.
So, but we still got a couple of minutes, so we should wait to see others.
And Rich, is there any way we can sort of make a special plea to really have a council liaison attend our meetings? Because that's really what ends up happening is that you or Linda end up having to inform the council about things without support from a council liaison. And I don't think that's fair.
Well, we've tried special pleas a little bit. We'll have a new mayor that may, I don't know. I mean, they've got to decide who gets to go where. And so I think it's really going to be up to who. I mean, maybe it would be Gina. So that's a possibility.
Well, that would be easiest.
Yes,
she has institutional memory. Because that's what I was
thinking.
Someone
who's really interested.
Right.
Committed.
Yeah.
So, Rich, I should tell you that I talked to Pam, and she had another meeting that was sort of right before this meeting, and she was wondering if she could come on at 4:45. I told her that would be fine. I usually just put guests at the front of the meeting so they don't have to sit through other stuff.
Yeah.
So if we'll just have to shift things around a little.
I think she's having a meeting with the OHSU nursing students working on Kahoot, because they're the ones I'm working with, and they had a meeting with her before this meeting. So
I think she's meeting with Brandon actually right now.
Oh, well, she had another, she must have them stacked.
Yeah, no kidding.
She had a meeting.
She's so busy.
Before this one. With the thing, so, and she had a really great one this morning, if anybody watched it, with the CCOs and the Oregon Health Authority. There was a forum on healthcare and where the CCOs are going and things, and Pam was one of the presenters on that issue.
Oh, and Linda, I want to apologize for having failed to attach.
Oh,
that's... And by the time you got back to me, it was kind of a moot point anyway. There were just a couple of things I thought we could add to that summary, but I don't think it matters, really, frankly, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, sorry it took me so long to get back to you. I saw that it wasn't attached, and then the phone rang, and then I was off on something else, and then I kept thinking, I need to get back, and then it was the day.
Yeah. That's okay. It's not that big a deal.
Well, so next time.
Gina's not here. Is there who else?
Linda Rapon, but I think she's planning to come. She's coming.
Okay, I was just trying to see when we get started. It's 4:00. Gina had asked whether she was kicked off. And we're pretty clear that that's not the case. So she's, but maybe she's still working to get here. But we could do the opening and approval of agenda, minutes, and then down to what we were discussing, the council's debrief. So I'll go ahead and open the November meeting of the Ashland Housing and Human Services Commission. And the number one thing on the agenda, as always, is the approval of the minutes. So do people have, Heidi, do you have an amendment to it?
Yes. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
Under the heading Affordable Housing Trust Fund and CDBG Award Update, I felt like we really should spell out, Linda gave a great summary, and I'm sure it's in the meeting notes, about the amounts and which funds they came from. So rather than, because this is a public record for people looking to see what happened at the meeting, I think we should list the amounts that were allocated and which pots of money they came from.
Ooh, that was a harder one.
I can easily do that. I have
it. Yeah, it's not that complicated.
And I'll just give it to Liz, and then she can put it in there. I should warn you all now that my internet connection can be spotty, as like everybody's, but for whatever reason, I guess it's a bandwidth thing. I'm not picky, but in the afternoons, sometimes it gets this thing where like everyone will freeze and it'll say your internet connection is unstable. And so I wouldn't normally bring it up, but because I'm the meeting host, it might disrupt your guys' ability. So if that happens, it will come back on and I will get the meeting going again. So I just want to let you know that in advance. In case that happens, hopefully it won't.
Okay,
so we've had a recommendation for an adjustment to the minutes. Are there other corrections or adjustments that people want to make? Hey, Linda, all right, and Gina. Can we have a motion to accept the minutes as amended?
So moved.
Echo a second. Gina, it's been moved in second. We accept the minutes as amended. All in favor, raise your hands. Any opposed? Any abstentions? Minutes are approved. So with our waiting for Pam to come to talk about manufactured housing, I guess we can move to the council update debrief, which we were kind of deeply involved in just before everybody got here. So Linda, do you want to start it about what we did at the council? And many of you may have seen it too.
Yeah, I guess I would start at first by saying that Rich did a great job. So we did have some prepared remarks that you all saw. And Rich did a really good job of going over them, and then, you know, but not exhaustively, I think, and just really doing a good job presenting. And a lot of questions were put out there by council members. So it felt like they were really interested in the work you guys were doing, and Rich did a great job of answering those. So on a side note, I had set up this meeting earlier in the day, and in order to do that, I have to do it on the city's, the city's Zoom account. So I had logged into Zoom, which I have to log in with the community development as the, you know, that's the login. And then I logged out. And then when I went to log into the council meeting, it logged me in as community development. And so I was sitting there waiting for, because Rich came in, and I was waiting for Adam to recognize me and bring my you know, my camera on and my audio on, and he didn't. And he said, oh, I guess it's just Rich here. So I was kind of panicking because I felt really bad that you were all alone, Rich. And so I was texting Brandon saying, do you think he can't see me? Why can't he see me? Should I log out and come back in? What should I do? And then I put something in the chat, but he still didn't know it was from me because it still said it was from community development. And then Rich started getting these questions, and I thought, oh my gosh, now Rich has to answer the questions all by himself, and I can't even help him, and they can't see that I'm here, and they think I didn't even come to the meeting. And then finally Adam said, oh, Linda is here. So, thank goodness. Oh my gosh. And Brandon was freaking out because I was supposed to be there for that item too. So he's like, where are you? It was kind of a nightmare, actually.
Rich, you did a great job, Rich.
Great job. Yeah. I mean, it was interesting that the council had to be kind of stopped by the mayor because he said we were getting into a study session, which kind of it was. But I think it does highlight the role that we're going to play in this next year. There's going to be a lot of opportunity for addressing so many of the issues that we've got. And that really highlights our December meeting, I think, and how we sort of outline our priorities. Sure.
I had some comments on the meeting.
Okay, yeah.
So three things are in my memory at any rate. I liked that Tanya started talking about the need for us to have a bigger picture. She used the phrase a continuum of housing. And I think that's a useful phrase. Everything from, and she acknowledged this, that there are people who want to camp, who want to be outdoors. They're not going to want to be inside. And we've all known folks in that category. But there's a whole continuum from that end into something like single residency occupancy, converted motel rooms, perhaps, which supposedly there's going to be some state money for that, however that shakes out, all the way up to really getting people into, you know, stick-built, you know, mobile homes and RVs, and then into sort of more stick-built permanent structures. So that, and not as renters, but on, you know, the other end of the continuum is actual ownership housing. So everything from informal housing, camping, to ownership. So that whole continuum, I think, is a good way to kind of organize our thinking. And then I also heard, I think mostly Tanya, stressing the need for having better regional coordination and cooperation and having a regional plan. And so Rich, it was great that you sort of reminded people there's this Medford plan that we said we were supporting. And I'd kind of forgotten the details of that, so I need to refresh my memory about it. I don't know how cooperative or willing to coordinate the other jurisdictions will be. So much change is happening, but it's certainly needed, particularly in the wake of the fire. So I thought that was really important. And then the third thing that struck me in the meeting was the way the word challenging was being used to refer to the Hardesty property. So in my experience, the word challenging is code word for it ain't gonna happen. But that's just me. So those are the three things that were stuck in my head at the end of the council meeting.
Gina.
So, yeah, Echo, good stuff. And Rich, thank you so much for going there and representing. And I did hear council staff Schlesinger bring up the Hardesty property.
Okay, yeah.
And I was surprised to hear her bring that up, but something that I really appreciated how her questions were answered. And I have been digging a little bit deeper. And I spoke to this young man, and it was so much resistance about the Hardesty property. But then on the other hand, he said that city properties can be used for temporary emergency housing. Well, if city properties can be used for temporary emergency housing, then how come we can't use the Hardesty property? Then I was looking at something. I've been reading so much, you guys, I'm sorry. But I was looking at something, and it said that the Hardesty property can be for sale. Surplus property can be for sale. And so I don't know if the city wants to sell it, and that's the resistance. The one thing that I am not really beholden to that property, I am beholden to the thought in the process of taking care of our unhoused, whatever property it might be on.
Right.
And then I was taking notes about, well, that wasn't in the meeting, that was in the capers, but I thought that yesterday the meeting went well. Unfortunately, some things didn't get processed the way I thought they would, but I thought it went well, and I think that Rich and Linda represented really good. And so we might still get the resistance from the Hardesty property, and that's fine. Then give us another property.
By the way, Gina, congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Can I ask Linda, can you give us a few minutes summary of the what do they call it, the Grand Ridge or the
Grand Terrace? Grand Terrace
annexation.
I can touch on it briefly. So it was just an annexation, which is like Echo was saying earlier, they don't have to have their project set in stone. They do have to show how they can or intend to meet all of the planning requirements for annexation, which if you watch the meeting, a lot of it was, road improvements and access and pedestrian and bicycle access and sidewalks. And it is a complex property because of its location with the frontage that really belongs to ODOT. And then that's a pretty high traffic area that's unimproved. And then there's the railroad and some wetlands. So there's a lot going on there. And I think the mayor had probably been prepped on this, and it's been something that I know we have talked about internally at the planning department, that with these changes coming to the land use code based on, the affordable housing standards that, you guys have been working on and hearing about that went to the council right before that, that if this project went through before, it would have different criteria than what it would need to meet after that annex or after that ordinance change is passed. And so I think what happened was that city staff talked to the developer and said, do you want to do it now, or do you want to wait until these things have been enacted, because they will impact your project? And the developer decided that they really wanted to be able to wait till after that was passed. And so I think that's what was conveyed to the mayor. And so trying to line it out so that we could get the ordinance enacted and then this development project through. And a lot of it had to do, I think, with that sort of wetlands buildable land piece, because of the way that we calculate that. What I heard from Rich in the past is his concern about the affordable housing component. like all annexations, this developer will be required to provide a percentage of affordable housing based on the number of units that they develop. I think at this point in the annexation process, they just have to show that they can meet the parking requirements for whatever density they are saying they can build out as. But that doesn't mean that they have to build that many units. That's the maximum amount they can build. And if they build that many, then they would be required to provide this many affordable housing. But it just depends on what they end up building in the end. And I do know that one of the issues going through the planning process with this development, as you guys may remember, the developer did come to the Housing Commission early on with a proposal. And then when he walked away, I remember everyone was saying, well, so are they one bedrooms or are they two bedrooms or are they studios? It was not clear what he was proposing. And I think that's been part of the problem with this application, is that I don't think he really quite knew what he was wanting at that point. And so I think it has changed and evolved over time. So I don't know that what is being proposed as the sort of development project is truly going to be what we're going to end up with. But regardless of what they end up with, he will have to provide that housing.
I just want to say that if it's rental housing, I just want to remind ourselves that they then would have a 60-year affordability requirement with that. So I'm happy with that. And if they sell them, then they could apparently go to the 30-year. But you would have then low-income homeowners, which is a good.
Yeah, and it just depends on what this ends up building out as. I think it's been proposed as rental projects. But, you know, I think what happens too with these development projects is that once they get through the annexation piece, which is an expensive and long process, you know, and then start looking at the actual development piece, but then that the economics of that development, it can sometimes drive those decisions later down the road. And the truth of the matter is that they can make more money back with sale housing than rental housing more quickly. And it might be easier to finance, you know. So, I think the other part is, you know, like all things, the housing market is changing so rapidly and things are so crazy. So, you know, once this starts getting underway or when they start really moving forward, it could be that there are different incentives in place at the state level or at the federal level that could influence how these build out. But regardless, we'll still get our affordable units, whether they're rental or ownership, and they will be subject to the new guidelines, which the council passed unanimously with no changes to the ordinance and then moved up the date. So December 1st, and then this project that we started way back in 2018 will be done.
Well, I'd like to just, before we move on, I just like to give an update, because we had two projects that we've had going at Snowberry 2, which I think is underway. But I was concerned about the project behind that Columbia Care has. Yeah. I checked in with them, and what they told me was that in mid-December, they're going to be signing the funding agreements. They have three major funders. So as they move from escrow, I don't even know about all this stuff. As they get to the final piece, they've got to decide what position different funders are in and get an agreement with those. But that is, I was assured, would be done in mid-December. And then early in next year, they would start the actual construction of those projects. They've already got the go ahead from the city, but I was worried that there hasn't been a bulldozer over there, but that's the timeline that I was recently told. So I think in all these cases, we just have to be, every meeting, we have to be, where are the next projects coming from? Where are the ones that were there? Because it takes so damn long to do it. But we got to have that long view as well as the emergency view of where people are staying.
Yeah,
Jackie.
I just had a question. I know I've asked this before, but maybe more has happened. On the 70 units, I believe, on Iowa and Garfield. Linda, you know what I'm talking about? I think it's 70 units. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. We can hear you. I think we might defer to Liz, who does more like current planning. So she's a little more up to date on what's going on with different things.
I'm like Rich. I'm waiting for the bulldozers.
The plans have been submitted. The check just arrived today. So the plans will go through the building review process. So I would say probably sometime in the spring, they'll start construction there as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Gina.
So if I heard this correctly, Columbia Care is 90 units.
No. Columbia Care is 25 to 30 units. And Snowberry is 60 units.
Yeah, I know Snowberry, and they're moving right along because they're by my house. So 25, 60, and then the 70 on Iowa and Garfield. Correct? Okay. And then how many at the Grand Ridge? It's the approximate number or...
Yeah, we
because
don't
only a percentage.
Yeah, so. It'll be a percentage of whatever they propose. And I mean, I think they are proposing quite a few. I mean, I think
192 is what they had in the, they did have 243 and now it's at 192. Something's changed.
Yeah, and I feel like the affordable housing portion in the beginning, they were looking at partnering with the housing authority and it was 30 units of affordable housing. But that will take, I mean, like it could change. And then I do want to point out that the 70 units are not regulated affordable housing.
Right.
The 90 or, you know, whatever, 85 to 90 are regulated in that they are deed restricted and required to maintain affordability over a long period of time. Whereas the 70 units are not necessarily, but they are a net addition to, yeah, they're very small. And they will be adding rental housing stock, which is something that we desperately need either way.
Well, if we're kind of done with the council and we don't have Pam yet, can we start the CAPR review approval? That's a huge long document. Did everybody get a chance to at least give it?
You know, it's actually not that long. It's the attachments that are long. So HUD, we use a database which is called integrated, why can't I think of this, disbursement something system, IDIS. Integrated disbursement, something. Anyway, sorry. It's actually where they give us money. It's the strangest thing. So we have the money comes in to our line item account, but then all of our documents are uploaded into this system so that everyone in HUD can see it. And it has all these reports that it spits out. So as it, I create all my activities in there. And so that's all the stuff at the end, which is like 30 or 40 pages of just the reports that this database spits out about the projects. And I know that for many of you, we've gone over the CAPR for many years, which is the Consolidated Annual Performance Evaluation Report. And it is the sort of the close up to the grant year. So at the beginning of the year, we offer the grant money, applicants come in, they apply for the grants and they tell us what they're going to do with the money. And then we grant them the money and we create that document called the annual action plan, which tells us, okay, we gave these people this amount of money and this is what they're going to do with it. And then theoretically they do that activity and they help however many people they help or they don't. And then we all that information gets compiled into the database. And then at the end, the close of the grant year, we say, okay, this is what we did with the money. And this is what actually happened. And it all relates back to that long 5-year plan that we have, where we sort of set out like in the next 5 years, here's our sort of goals for how we're going to spend this money. And so this year is the actual close of that 5-year period. So it has all those strange tables in it that kind of run all the way to the edge of the paper, and I can't get them to not stay on there in a better way. And then it breaks down these weird percentage numbers that are just based on the information that we put in the database, and it spits out these percentages. And so for some things, it's pretty disappointing. Like, we put in that obviously our highest priority is the provision of affordable housing, and if applications came in for affordable housing that were viable from organizations that we felt had the capacity, we would fund those activities because that is our biggest goal. But in that 5-year period, we didn't have anyone apply for affordable housing. So we did not meet that 50 unit goal that we set out. We did meet a lot of other goals. Our goals for homelessness, we have exceeded. Public facilities, we've exceeded because of, you can really do very little with public facilities and meet a huge number. And then housing rehab, which was through the organization who just changed their name. Oh, I can't think of what they're called now, but in partnership with the Ashland Fire Department, who is doing retrofitting on homes to make them more ADA accessible. So that helped us meet those goals. Of course, this year, so for this CAPR year, we funded Maslow Project, and they were able to assist 117 children with the funding and the leverage that they brought in. We also funded St. Vincent de Paul through the rental assistance program and security deposit. And they were able to help 27 households with that funding in this year and their matching funding. And then we also funded Food Angels to help repair their facility. And Food Angels, actually, the way they count is just all the people who benefit from the food activities that they do, which is thousands. So that's a huge number. And then because of the COVID money that we received, the CARES Act money, we actually did go back to our 2019 action plan. And this is what HUD told us. You can adjust your 2019 action plan or your 2020 action plan, but you just have to pick one and keep amending that one. So we chose to amend our 2019 action plan. And so two activities that we funded with that CARES Act money has already been completed, and we were able to put those results in this CAPR. But there are other activities that we're funding, and we're still amending, you know, our action plan to include more activities. And so those will have to get reported in the next year. But of those two activities, one was the hotel vouchers for Options for Helping Residents of Ashland, which I think was around 57 residents were housed over 61 days or 67 days. Anyway, might be getting my numbers mixed up. And that was at the beginning of COVID when the shelter had to close and they transitioned some people into hotels. And then we were able to help with that a little more. And then they also partnered with Peace House to do meal delivery while Peace House created the meals. And so we did fund Peace House to provide those meals. And they, at the beginning, they didn't provide as many meals as it was ramping up. But eventually they went to providing 125 prepackaged meals 4 days a week. So as you can imagine, that ran into the thousands as well. And it's not necessarily thousands of people, it's thousands of meals. So that's a little confusing, I think, in the reporting criteria, but it could be the same 125 people, but they've been doing it, you know, since March. So it's quite a few. I mean, we're providing a lot of meals for people. And then the last thing that we did that closed out before the end of the reporting period was getting the shower trailer back online. And so that was kind of a strange activity. And you probably will remember that Aura was unable to open the shower trailer because volunteers had been the ones who were registering people for the showers or signing people up and then cleaning the showers. But because of COVID, their volunteers were not able to do that work, and they just wanted to make sure people could do it safely. So we were able to use some old capital funding to do an economic development project, which I have to tell you, we have never done an economic development project in the city of Ashland. It just never works out. There just aren't any that come forward. So it was kind of fun. And I've never had to do reporting criteria for that before. So it was very unusual. And it falls under the category of micro enterprise. So we hired owner operator cleaners who also were minorities and a minority owned business. So that was great. And they came in and cleaned the shower trailer. So we were able to open that. The interesting thing about that is that you count economic development activities in how many jobs were maintained or created in FTEs. And so it was sort of half an FTE or something because it was just, a couple hours, a couple times a week. But anyway, so that was the other activity that got reported in this CAPR period. And then, like I said, it's sort of the end of our five-year cycle. And then that consolidated plan that you guys adopted earlier in this year, we're beginning that new cycle in which we will most likely meet our housing goal because all these housing units will be built, even though we won't really have supported them with CDBG funding. So I'm happy to take any questions or if anyone has any comments about the CAPR. I know these are long, boring, dry documents and that their formatting is really weird. So I apologize for that.
Jackie.
I just had a question in the back. One of the charts I was looking at, one of them is page 55, but it doesn't matter. It's the charts that's showing the drawn down amounts. And I guess I just wanted to ask you, is there anything that you felt didn't get drawn down as much as it should have, or any concerns about that?
Probably not. Drawdowns are strange. So for inactivity, so this tracks things in program year. And for an activity, the money gets allocated into that account, and then you just draw from that account until it's gone. But the CAPR is only going to count what is drawn in that program year. And I mean, we're supposed to sort of treat it that way too. So like St. Vincent de Paul often ran into the next year because they would not draw down all their money in the given year. The other thing that HUD generally, so all HUD funding is a reimbursement. So they have to spend the money first and then give me invoices and say, can you reimburse me for all this money we spent? But small organizations that can't float that much money, like for instance,
Food Angels, right.
So Food Angels would need to constantly submit invoices. And you can submit the invoices that you actually haven't paid for. It's just you've already been, the work has been incurred. And the reason is because you want to be able to go in and say, it is here and it is, good work. It's not, faulty. We're not going to pay for something that then is a problem. So I had to work very closely with Pamela to get things, to keep things working right for her books. And the process of drawing money down from HUD is not all that quick because it has to go through the city system too. So it just takes a week or two to get that funding processed, not including making sure that all the dollar amounts are right. So I would say, while it isn't concerning to me because I do know that both of those organizations will spend down all of their money because I have had experience at least with St. Vincent de Paul, but also I know that Pamela can easily incur those costs. But HUD would say that you do need to be aware of those things and you do need to make sure that organization is drawing down funds in a timely manner because you don't want to have your money sitting out there with a project that is stalled. Or if it's not moving forward for some reason, I may have to go in and say, what's going on? Are you going to be able to complete this project? Or do I need to reallocate that money to another purpose? And so it is good to be aware of if you're not drawing down the money quick enough, is it because you have hit a snag and you can't move forward? So I think that's really astute of you, Jackie, to have noticed that.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Gina?
Gina, go ahead.
Okay, there we go. So I had a question. I don't know what page it was on. I was just making notes. And at one point we were looking at fair housing training for landlords and property management companies. And I was reading that, but I don't know where it left off. And it said that we had the fair housing training and then the hotline that people could connect if they had questions. So where would, and then I thought about the students when it comes to fair housing for the students, and how can they connect to that?
Those are all really good questions, Gina. So kind of like all the documents that we write for HUD, they need to be comprehensive and take into account all of the, what are they called? All of the regulations that federal funding is held to. So as you guys all know, because we've talked about this recently, fair housing is, I mean, because we are a jurisdiction that receives federal funding, we are required to do what they call affirmatively furthering fair housing. So in every document we prepare, we talk about how we plan to address that need. And then, like, as this is the sort of closeout of the year, how did we address that need? And most of the time, the way we address that need is by offering a training, usually just one, because we're too poor to offer more. Mm-hmm. And we contract with the Fair Housing Council of Oregon to offer their hotline services to our area, which honestly they would anyway, but they need support. So we generally give them some money, and that money is sort of in an umbrella contract of, you know, why don't you do a training and then you'll provide us the hotline and, you know, materials and support in whatever way you can. So the hotline on the City of Ashland's website, we have a fair housing page, which is under the housing program, which is under the Community Development Department. It's kind of hard to get there, but it is there. I think you could probably type in fair housing in the search bar. On the fair housing page is all the information about the Fair Housing Council of Oregon and a link to their hotline phone number. And everyone has access to that, including students. Also on the landlord-tenant page, we have that same link to the Fair Housing Council of Oregon. Now, their hotline is not a, like, 24/7 manned hotline. So you do have to kind of be patient with that. The other resources that we support for fair housing are the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services, which is a sort of local organization to address both fair housing, and they do landlord-tenant stuff, but fair housing is within their wheelhouse. And so that's another number that students or anyone can call. And that information is also on our landlord-tenant page.
I got a comment and a question. On the comment side, we do have a new fair housing person for Southern Oregon, Meg Tinnen. So maybe some of you, I've known her from the CAHOOTS work. And so we actually have our own Southern Oregon person here now. But it leads me to one of the things that I found surprising. And I know every year or two we approve these CAPERs. I kind of wondered to what extent do they just approve them kind of, okay, that looks okay, or whether they jump on you for some reason.
Well, and, they jump on me all the time.
let me say what I found interesting was there was a breakdown on one page, and I don't know which was, of the racial data for people served. And it was unbelievable that we had two African Americans, two other people of color, and 9,170 white people. I mean, that isn't even that's lower than their percentage in the population. And I just wondered,
well, I'll explain.
Is that real?
No, it's not.
It's so, not real. Okay.
Okay, so here are the activities that we did. So one of the activities was Maslow. Maslow obviously directly helps people, so they can take that racial data right then, because it's sort of self-certified anyway. You know, they just say, like, how do you identify? And St. Vincent de Paul can do that too, right? Like, they're going to help people directly, and so they can see them and ask them to fill this out. Food Angels does not do that. They are just providing food to you know, Head Start and the Woodlot and then the food bank. And so they know that the food bank serves 2,000 people or whatever. And they also know that Head Start serves, you know, what, 300 families in a year or something. but they don't have any breakdown of the racial components because they're not doing a direct service and they're not having them fill out that paperwork. But they do know that they're low income, because if you are using the food bank, then you are presumed a benefit of a low income. And the Food Angels activity is looked at as a public facility food bank. And so we don't know the racial component of what of the people who are gaining or benefiting from that service. And then the other one is interesting because it's the public facility improvement. So public facility improvement that we did was to add audible signals. And so part of the number that shows up in that spreadsheet is the number of people who benefit from audible signals. And the only number we have is the number of people who would need an audible signal, which would be sight impaired people. And so we just look at census data and say, how many sight impaired people are there? That is the number that are benefiting from this public facility improvement that we did. We don't know what their racial breakdown is because the census data isn't providing that necessarily. And they are a presumed benefit population because they have a disability. And so those numbers are reflective of those sort of large groups of people that we don't have breakdowns for.
Right. But that makes, just in my mind, that makes the default position white people. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I don't know why that is, but I mean, it seems to be there could be another category of unknown, perhaps. I don't know. Anyway, I just thought that the numbers really hopefully doesn't reflect what we are actually people we're serving. But
well, and it's artificially inflated because even if there are, you know, 3,000 sight impaired people in the city of Ashland, are they all really going to be using that crosswalk in a given year? I'm not sure. And I could actually break it down into just other, and I could base it on, you know, the census data's breakdown of our racial mix. But Linda, I didn't do that.
Yeah. Is it possible to have that a requirement from the city to count those numbers more accurately?
Well, we do traffic studies. I don't know that if we would do a pedestrian traffic study. I don't know if they can.
But if we're awarding money to an agency and they're not tracking the demographics, it seems like the number could be tracked through Head Start, for example. And
Head Start has it.
Well, but you said the organization is operating through other organizations like Head Start that track the numbers. So I think that would be at least a step to making us look less racist.
And I could certainly ask Pamela to get information from the food bank, because I think the food bank does keep some information as well, only because we funded the food bank in the past and they can provide that information. But they're more, you know, like Head Start and Food Bank could do it. I think they're just more specific. I know there are other groups that she provides food to that we just wouldn't count. But I can certainly ask.
Your answer was the default answer that we don't have very many people of color in Ashland. But I think it would be valid to take it a couple of steps further, just to comply.
Mm-hmm. Chris?
Well,
Chris has something.
Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, so I know with education, you know, funding, especially with grants, you know, there's usually consequences sometimes when you don't meet your objectives. What's the case in this part where we didn't meet that one? Is there long-term consequences for not meeting objective?
So the short answer is no. There is a long answer that is yes. If we never met any objectives, they would probably say, why do you set out these objectives? Because we write them, right? Like, we're saying this is what we're going to do. And I think the hard part about being a grantee that doesn't undertake the activity, so, you know, we put it out there and then we hope someone comes in and says they want to do it. If we were doing the activity, I think that would be different, because in the way that we put it out there, we just don't have any control over those things. And we tend to make our objectives obviously pointed to the thing that we want, so that, you know, that has the priority. But we also have to keep them broad so that we can allow for those activities should they come in. So like, we've never done an economic development activity, but we always have a placeholder for one, because if one does come in and it's the only thing there, we want to be able to fund it and have it meet a goal. If we don't have any goals, then really HUD would say, well, why are you funding an activity that you don't have any goals for?
Right.
But we
I just didn't know if there was, like, you know, like, I know with some education grants, you have to meet like 90% of your objectives. So I didn't know if that was the same case with HUD.
Well, we could get labeled as low performing. And that could jeopardize us at some point in time. I don't think it's ever happened, though. Like, the continuum of care grants that are a HUD grant are much more stringent than this. But as going back to what Rich was saying, there are things that we do get in trouble for. So when we send up all these documents to HUD, it's kind of like in the planning department where it has to go through all these different departments and they have to look over their section. And one of the sections is fair housing and equal opportunity. And they get mad at us a lot. Linda, are you having troubles hearing? Is everybody else experiencing any sound? Okay. Because it could be my internet. I just want to make sure. But fair housing and equal opportunity gets very angry at us. Oh. I heard you talk, Linda, but it was delayed. anyway, fair.
It might be my internet.
Oh, okay.
It seems to help the people mute.
Okay. So, anyway, fair housing equal opportunity would like us to do more. I think the challenge for a small community like Ashland, that is also a very small grantee, is that we just don't have the money to do more. And so that is another challenge that I have brought up to fair housing before. Sometimes they hold up all our money because they won't approve our plans because they say we need to do more fair housing, but eventually it gets through, but sometimes it takes a long time. So you are right. We can get in trouble, and we have gotten in trouble.
Are we ready to take a vote on this? And then let's just do it one at a time. If we're ready to take a vote, would someone move to accept the CAPR report for 2020? Jackie, but you're muted.
It's actually 2019.
So 2019. CAPR, okay. 2019.
Would you like to move that? Oh, Chris.
I'd like to move that we accept the CAPR plan 2019.
It's been moved, seconded. Gina, all in favor of approving? Well, is there any discussion about it more than we've already had? If not, all those in favor of approving the 2019 CAPR report, raise your hand. Okay. Any opposed and any abstentions? It looks like we've carried that motion. So have we found out whether Pam Marsh is lining up anywhere?
Well, I don't see anything from her. I just checked my email and she has the link just like yours. So that's not a waiting room. She would just pop right in. And I'm not seeing anything else. I'm just checking all these little icons I have down here. And I checked my email and I didn't receive an email. So I guess she's just running late. So we can just continue going until she gets here.
Okay. Well, then the next thing, it seems to be the Pallet Shelter Pilot Project Overview. This is a long name. It looks like a good idea. Do you want to highlight it for us, Linda?
Sure. So, as you know, back to the council meeting on Tuesday, there was a lot of discussion about regional coordination and sort of what's going on to address the need and how are we working together to do that. And, you know, one of the things, oh, here's Pam. Do you want to wait for this and we can do Pam's thing? What do you guys think?
Oh,
let's do Pam.
Yeah.
Pam, thank you.
Hi. Hi. Lovely to see you. All of you in your native environments. Rich, I just left a call with Karen Rich. So she's probably in the other room, right? And you're in that room. My husband and I fight over the office because it's so nice to have a space where it's actually isolated and nobody can walk by in the background, although he does anyway. I am happy to cover whatever territory is useful today. I think you have made a connection with Chelsea Caddo at the state level. Is she going to be attending your retreat coming up?
Actually, we're going to talk about that after this item.
Okay. My understanding from Linda and from others of you is that we wanted to sort of cover the manufactured home territory and talk specifically about what's happening and what the possibilities are in the co-op model of manufactured home parks. Is that right? So I'll just start with some broad introduction. I got actually involved in manufactured home parks during my initial campaign to run for the state legislature because I heard about a case in Shady Cove where a single dad had bought himself a unit and scratched together all of his pennies, was in a park, had an increase in park rentals from $400 to $800, could not afford that, had to leave his unit, eventually lost his unit to the predatory landlord. In this case, that gentleman and his kids wound up in some affordable housing because he had a good attorney, Doug McGarry, who many of you know from past involvement with the city of Ashland or other issues in the community. But the story was horrifying, and it really took me back. Many years ago, I worked for a state legislator in California right when Santa Clara County was really starting to go through an intense period of development, and our manufactured home park started to close, and the legislator I was working on was really key in some of the legislation that was put on the table at that time around the rights of individual park residents when a park owner chooses to close the doors. As you know, it's a really peculiar arrangement being a manufactured park resident. Typically, you own your own unit. You bought that unit. New units range from $50,000 to $150,000. A lot of what we have on the ground has been units that have been in use for a very long time. So they are typically for sale for even much less than that. And you pay rent to your park owner. So you've got something of your own equity, of your own ownership, but these are not essentially mobile units as are sort of described traditionally. There are very few of these units that can actually move. When a park owner chooses to go away and shut down, you've lost your home, you've lost your equity, you are out on the street, basically. So legislation was developed in California and later in Oregon around the obligations of a park owner to individual residents. And it basically requires some notification in the state of Oregon. It also requires that residents be given an opportunity to consider whether or not they can buy the park. It is not a right of first refusal. It is simply an early notification to park residents. So that protective legislation has been on the ground for some period of time in Oregon. So 4 years ago, when I came to the legislature, the first thing I did, I'd heard about this awful case, Doug McGarry's client, and I put in a piece of legislation that in fact would give park residents a right of first refusal when a park went on the market. And let me tell you, in Salem, when you don't know anybody, putting out a piece of legislation like that is a really good way to quickly get to know everybody in the manufactured park world, because all of a sudden they're at your door and in your office telling you about everything that's happened in the past and all the reasons you shouldn't be doing this and all the obstacles that you will face. And so it was like this tremendous introduction into the manufactured park world. And we did not pass that piece of legislation, and I'm less keen on it now for a variety of reasons that we could talk about that probably aren't relevant, but it did introduce me to many of the people in the manufactured park world. And then 2 years ago, I had a piece of legislation, House Bill 2896, that I did in concert with a number of advocates, primary among those being Bill Van Vliet from NOAA, which is a CDFI in Portland that does a lot of financing around manufactured home parks. And the legislation that we passed put $9.5 million into the purchase of parks. So a park comes on the market. There's an opportunity for residents or a nonprofit or a housing authority to buy the park at competitive price. The $9.5 million was intended to be flexible money that could be accessed to take advantage of these opportunities. And it was also to be managed by an outside entity so that we would have an opportunity to draw private funding also into that fund, and thereby to leverage a contribution on the state for many more dollars in the outside world and make the work go much farther. It also included $2.5 million for a program to encourage individual homeowners to upgrade their units. We know that manufactured units comprise 8 to 10% of the state's total housing stock, which I think is an incredible statistic. It's a significant contributor to the housing stock. We have 1,100 parks. Some of that is about, half of that is in parks, about half of it is on parcels of land scattered across the landscape. We have 1,100 parks. In the state of Oregon, we have had until recently 104 parks in our county alone. So but we know that many of those units, probably 40% of those units, are pre-1980 units, very old homes that were purchased and put on their sites long before HUD was even regulating manufactured homes. And while they are homes and they are places to be, they are energy inefficient. They are built with a lot of asbestos and potentially other toxic materials, and they aren't as healthy as environment as people deserve. So we put $2.5 million into a program to just upgrade people, to get them out of their old units. We provided some of that money for grants just for disposal, because it's really hard to get rid of an old manufactured home because of the fact that it contains so many toxins. So we designed a system of grants that would come out of the state up to $35,000 for the purchase of a new home. Clearly that wouldn't cover the full cost, but in concert with some private financing that's being put together by a great partnership with Craft 3 and the Energy Trust, which covers territories largely outside of Ashland, since we have our own municipal utility. Then we thought you could get a financing package that would actually be attractive for people to upgrade their units. So we did that legislation 2 years ago with the intention of really providing an avenue for alternative ownership of parks, because we believe that if you own your own unit and that unit sits in a park that has your best interests in mind all the time, that you really have developed a wonderful neighborhood and supportive environment for the residents. There are, out of those 1,100 parks statewide, only 27 right now are in alternative ownership. And that's a combination of co-op parks and nonprofit-owned parks. St. Vincent de Paul in Lane County has been a bit very active in this space. They own a number of parks, and there's also some electric co-ops that have been very active in this space. So then, from our perspective, the story goes immediately to September 8th and the destruction of 19 or 20 of our manufactured home parks and RV parks across Jackson County up and down Highway 99. And now, you know, the knowledge that I've gained in the manufactured home park world became startlingly relevant. The day after the fires, I was texting Bill Van Vliet saying, but NOAA saying, I think we're going to have to rebuild some manufactured home parks. Because remember, in those early days, we didn't even know what had happened in our community, but it was pretty easy to understand what had happened in the manufactured home parks, because we know where those parks are. We have them mapped at the state level. We know how many units there are in every one of those parks. And within a couple of days, I knew in talking to my people upstate that we probably had at least 1,500 homes that had been destroyed. The actual number, of course, was probably closer to 1,700 or 1,800. And then the additional brick and mortar homes giving us a total of 2,500 homes destroyed in that fire. So now we are trying to look at what's happened on the ground and figure out how to use whatever state resources we have to encourage redevelopment. To be very clear, any private parks that redevelop now are going to come in at a very different price point than they were before. We had our manufactured home parks were the refuge of our most vulnerable population, our seniors, our low and moderate income working people, and our Latinx populations. They bought homes at $20,000, $30,000, maybe $60,000. Those homes don't exist. They cannot be brought into those parks. There are not 30 or year old manufactured homes that will replace those homes. So a park that rebuilds will rebuild with new homes. The new homes are going to cost, depending on what kind, how the park decides to design, they're going to cost $50,000 to $150,000. Inevitably, the park rentals are going to go up because the park has, first of all, an opportunity to do so. And secondly, legitimate expenses in the rebuilding of a park. These parks have suffered a tremendous damage, as did the residents. And then they're still going to be under private ownership. So there's still some risks involved in that for residents. You know, we have tons of wonderful park owners, but more and more, those park owners are, frankly, aging out of the system. And it turns out their kids mostly don't want to run a manufactured home park. It's been viewed from corporate interests. And you can find lots of articles about this if you start Googling it, as a great investment, because you got all of these people who are basically locked in place, who are just paying you rent every month, right? There's not a lot of overhead to this once you take care of the capital investments. So while I think we want to encourage the manufactured home parks to come back, we should realize strategically as a community that that does not replace what we lost. And we, I think there's, out of this comes a tremendous interest in looking at how we can use our state resources to support the development of parks that are, and we haven't had any of these alternatively owned parks in this part of the world. Look at what we might do to actually get some parks that are owner owned or nonprofit managed or housing authority governed, so that we have stability, predictability, long-term viability for people to be part of those neighborhoods. The folks up north and Rich Rohde know lots of details about how these cooperative parks come together and how they are modeled. I mean, but basically you're just talking about a big co-op where the owners own all of the land and the common facilities, and then separately typically own their own units. And then there's a governance model that has to be put together. Clearly that's a somewhat sophisticated model. You have to have residents who have the capability or the outside guidance to understand how to manage a community. Anybody who's ever been part of an HOA for a condominium knows that people can be cranky, right? So you have to be able to negotiate that. But then when you do, it just seems like a wonderful outcome for people.
Question, folks.
Pardon?
I was just opening for questions.
Oh, yeah.
Wanted to
So if you want, let me just say, if the desire of this group is to delve more into how you would support development of co-ops, what that would consist of, what kind of money you have to have up front, I think Chelsea or the people at CASA, Chelsea used to run CASA, which is the predominant agency in the state that puts together these co-ops. My knowledge is much more in the legislating general realm. And I can share with you also my passion for these little neighborhoods, but I don't have the technical knowledge.
Jackie.
I just want to say that I had the opportunity to go to the manufactured housing forum that you put together, Pam, and that was maybe 2 years ago.
Yeah, 2 years ago.
And what I want to say is I was so impressed with the groups that were there from these cooperatives. Mm-hmm. Who were so happy and proud of what they had accomplished. And then also the gentleman, I don't know if it was Van Fleet, but from NOAA, who mm-hmm. was talking about how, you know, how they did this, where they would go into these parks, they would have to find the money with all these different foundations and private ownerships, and they would pull everyone out, put them in hotels and some kind of housing. They would scrape the park, he called it, and then they would put down all these new mobile homes, and then they would bring in all the people back from the hotels and the apartments that they had been in, and then they still managed only to raise the rent by about $10 to $15 a month. And it was just amazing to me what they were able to accomplish. So I mean, I love the idea of trying to keep going and talking to someone that could tell us more and maybe give us small steps. The problem I see is I think the mobile home park that burned up near us over there by Valley mm-hmm. Inn or whatever, that's county, right? Mm-hmm. So that makes it very complicated and challenging. So, but anyway, thank you for that forum. It was excellent.
Oh, good. And yeah. And we do have manufactured home parks within our own boundaries. The interesting thing about manufacturing, you know, when you see those numbers, 1,100 parks, 104 parks in Jackson County, it's hard numbers to understand until you actually start paying attention. And then you see the parks that are just tucked into various corners of our community. I mean, up and down Highway 99, and not all parks were burned. We burned 20 parks. That's an incredible amount of damage in a very focused area.
So I got three quick points. One, we do have in Ashland a nonprofit in Umpqua NeighborWorks that is already had a land-trusted mobile park mm-hmm. Project that is very successful in the Roseburg in Douglas right. County. And I talked with them, and it's like, where is the opportunity? But they were very interested in that model and could it be used in our area. Second part is Wingspread has, at least as I understand it, they have a tenant purchasing group mm-hmm. that if it ever sold, they're already organized mm-hmm. to do it. And then I guess the last thing that I would, this is just my own personal thing from having been in there, is that when people are burned out or their project is sold, but really that's when people lose that. That's one of the really big tragedies. So we got a lot to work on keeping those in our community where we can. And I think at some point could be asked to come in and highlight the details of a land trusted thing.
And I think another asset I would just add to that is Jackson County Housing Authority. I've been pushing them to get into the manufactured housing realm, and they haven't seen the opportunity, but now they see we have lots of opportunities. So I think
Great. It's
a good, you know, we have a good background for having this conversation.
Linda, and then Echo.
I am concerned about putting more mobile home parks back where they were if they aren't more fire resistant than the ones that were there. Is the technology changed in the, you know, the, from the 1980 versions?
Well, the materials have changed. Modern manufactured home parks don't have asbestos in them. I mean, that was one of the, that's been one of the real problems that we've had, is you've had this debris and ash, which is just infected with toxins and asbestos. So they are energy efficient. They are built with good materials. You know, whenever you have housing that's close to each other, you have more of a risk. That's by its nature a manufactured home park. I think there are probably some ways to look at overhangs and awnings and carports so that you have less connection, a little bit more protection between units. It is also true that the kind of fire that we had just consumed everything in its path that it touched, you know, those brick and mortar subdivisions that were in Talent that just were devastated, incinerated, weren't manufactured homes. But there's also no question that they are more vulnerable because of the fact they're closer together. And typically we haven't probably done as good a work ahead of time to make sure that people understand best practices in terms of where they leave stuff and how their overhang touches a neighbor's, or, you know, the things that we know can convey fire.
And one more question, what about insurance? Are they going to be insurable moving forward?
All these manufactured homes were insurable. If people tell you they weren't insurable,
are the insurance companies going to continue to offer insurance given what happened?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, I haven't heard a worry about that. Certainly something we should watch. You can insure a manufactured home too for replacement value, but you know, these homes that people lived in were of very modest value. So in many cases, they were just uninsured because people made the same kinds of risk calculations that all of us make when we're confronted with an expenditure, and it didn't seem worth it. So a lot of the homes that were incinerated are just gone.
Echo.
So Pam, you and I have been crossing paths a lot on Facebook pages, and I want to thank you for the help you've been offering to people on those Facebook sites. It's been incredibly helpful.
Okay.
So thank you. One thing that I'm thinking as I listen to this is that there's the immediate crisis that people are in right now, dealing with insurance issues, you know, really confusing, getting ripped off, really, some people having good experiences, some people having terrible experiences. One of the people that I know that got me interested in this topic is apparently getting seriously jerked around by Allstate and is currently camping in an RV. And isn't sure where she can put it and what's going to happen. And there's some mental health issues with her. Even though she's very bright, she's emotionally volatile. So it's really difficult for her to manage. And, you know, so there's all of those challenges in the short term with insurance companies and some bad actors among park owners, some bad actors among property management companies. So there's all that just immediate crisis. What are we, you know, where am I going to live in a month? But then we do have to think this about long-term, about alternative ownership models. So the challenge that I think we've got in part is turning the energy to, once people are able to get out of the immediate crisis, turning their energy, helping them redirect it into longer term planning, at least the folks who are deciding to stay. So one of the people that you and I interact with a lot on Facebook is Misty Munoz. Mm-hmm. And she's kind of the poster child for this, I think, mm-hmm. Because she's starting, as you've noticed, she's starting to organize some park sort of liaison leadership, mm-hmm. from the parks, particularly around Phoenix and Talent. And at the moment, I think that effort's going to be focused on the short-term insurance, park owner, legal issues. But that can be the seed for this longer-term activism that clearly needs to happen in order to make these alternative ownership structures happen. It's going to take grassroots activists to make that happen as well.
Yeah.
So do you have any thought about how to help us navigate that transition from crisis into sort of longer term planning?
Well, I think the first thing is that we're going to have to be effectively help people address, in fact, the crisis. Is that we have nothing in statute that addresses a situation like this and protects manufactured homeowners. So I'm working with John Van Lanningham, who many of you know is the preeminent expert in manufactured home law, works for Oregon Law Center, previously for Lane County Legal Aid, and knows everything about manufactured homes. And we're going to do a piece of legislation that will make it really clear in the next disaster, what happens on the day of the disaster, when prepaid rent should be automatically returned to tenants, what responsibilities exist around cleanup in a case like this. The answer is nothing, no responsibilities to the homeowner. And we're gonna put all of that in the piece of legislation so we don't have all of these questions next time, and that will help. But the crisis is so immediate at this moment. And I don't know how many of you are on social media, but I am just starting to see sort of like we went through the first month and it was all adrenaline fueled and people found a place to be and it was all about just staying safe. And now the intense grief is coming out, and I see it constantly articulated on Facebook as people reach out and people who in some cases seemed to make a transition really fast to another environment and bought a new house and now they're just breaking down. I mean, we are still so much in the moment of the crisis that I think we have to really pay attention to that. And at the same time, and not expect more of people than trying to provide the support that they are asking for so clearly. And we can't wait. You're right. We can't wait long to start offering people hope, because we're going to be asking people who have been burned out to spend a couple of years in some wacky living situation, whatever it is. In the best case, maybe it's a FEMA unit or somebody's backyard unit that they've been able to rent. That will not work for undocumented community. So we still have a lot of work to do there. But then what happens to them after 2 years, right? Yeah. What have they hung out waiting for, unless we are able to offer some hope pretty soon that we're all going to, you know, that there will be resources and alignment and support to allow them to be a long-term member of the community. So it's really parallel tracks, but I think people are just hanging on right now. When what Rich said a minute ago about people losing their neighborhoods, I hear that constantly. And I made a presentation on our fire to Oregon Health Forum this morning. And I pulled out a quote just from Facebook that I didn't wind up using, but it was a quote from that some of you have probably seen that said, this is part of a long tract of sorrow that's being expressed. And the quote is, many like myself had paid off our homes and have chosen to live simply. Now we were out in the world where rent is three times our space rent. And we are not in a community. We are not in our village. We are all displaced. Just the people lost their homes, but they lost their place, their sense of security there.
That's my friend Shauna who wrote that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, we're kind of running out of time around this thing. So I want to just see if there's a last question or a last summation, Pam, you want to do? Because we do have a few other pieces on the agenda.
Yeah. I don't think I need to add anything more, except I really value and appreciate your interest in this. You know, this was bad enough to lose 2,500 homes, but to lose this kind of housing just makes this, I think, nothing less than a humanitarian disaster. So it's going to take all of us paying attention to it in the years to come.
Well, Pam, I know from our whole commission, really, thank you for being here. Thank you for all the work, and it's going to continue. So
continue.
I'm sure we'll be all connected down the way. So if you want, we're going to move into the Pallet Shelter Pilot Project. You're welcome to listen to that. But I think Linda's going to give that. So if you want to hear what we're doing on this pilot project, we'll welcome you.
You know, I would love to say that this is about my 10th Zoom of the day, and I need to go get something.
Yeah.
So thank you all so much for the chance to be with you, though. Bye.
Thanks, Pam.
Bye, Pam. Thanks. Okay, back to pallet shelters. So there is a statewide group that I have mentioned before that came up out of the COVID crisis. And in the beginning, it was really the collection of continuums of care throughout the state and other homeless service providers. And it's just been, you know, getting together each Friday and talking about what everyone is doing. And then it's led by the Oregon Housing Community Services, the state agency that provides funding for housing and homeless services, letting everyone know what resources were available or coming available to address their concerns. So then sort of after the wildfires and with the coming of winter, they pivoted to how will we address our cold weather shelter needs. And there's representation throughout the state from, you know, large cities like Portland and counties that have lots of resources all the way to, it seems like the Dalles doesn't have anything. I'm always hearing from the Dalles that they don't have any shelter providers or homeless service providers or trucks or, you know, shower trucks. And but it's interesting because down here, you know, I hear some things that other people have and I think, boy, we could really use that. So it's been a great group to talk about all the different things that are going on. But they definitely were talking about how will we address our cold weather shelter needs. So that was one sort of coordinated discussion that was going on. And then locally, we have our continuum of care and a small subset, which was called, I think it's called like Sheriff Sickler's Greenway Group. And so they actually met for a long time every Wednesday and then went to every 2 weeks. And I've been involved in that discussion. And that was more about how do we address the needs of the Greenway at the beginning of COVID. But then it turned into the urban campgrounds because that's what, you know, the way that they addressed the Greenway issue. And with the urban campground came all this great new information and what was working and what wasn't working and, you know, that model. But part of that, too, was, okay, winter is coming. We're not going to allow these people to camp here anymore. You know, how are we going to address this? And at about that time, Rogue Retreat received a donation of 10 of these pallet shelters to put at their urban campground. So everyone was thinking about how do we address this? And I had been talking with the city administrator about what we were going to do. Because traditionally what we have done is that we have Aura offering their winter shelter program where people register and then they're there for a period of time. They have a bed until they transition out and then they can pull someone else off that list. And then we know that they can't address all of the need that's out there. And we also know that there's a certain subset of the homeless population that just cannot be in that setting. They just don't do well and can't follow the rules or and end up not being able to stay. And Jason and Vanessa Hauk from Southern Oregon Jobs with Justice has traditionally opened the emergency cold weather shelter to address just that emergent need of this pretty difficult to serve population or people who just don't, you know, want to go through the ORA process or were not or not able to get in. So it was always their goal to have a low barrier shelter available for people to utilize. But as we know, Jason and Vanessa were very impacted by the fires and are just really trying to deal with their own things. So I met early on with Chad from Rogue Retreat to talk about what his model is and how it's working and how they're going to be addressing cold weather shelter, because obviously they also have the Kelly shelter. And in the years past, the Kelly shelter was the emergency cold weather shelter, but grew into the more permanent shelter that it is now. I also met with the Jackson County Continuum of Care manager, Connie Wilkerson, to talk with her about what is she seeing and what is she hearing. Our main concern was that while Aura was still running their shelter and they have a capacity that's similar to the capacity they've had in years past, that we know that in inclement weather events, you know, we have anywhere between 5 and up to like 25 people who will take advantage of the cold weather shelter. But we also know that because of the fires, there are some people who were camping on the Greenway and that they are now displaced. And so where will they go? Will they go north or will they go south? Will they be wanting to be housed in Ashland? Or, you know, will they take advantage of, you know, what's going on in Medford and maybe get into the urban campground? So through all the discussions that I had, oh, and I met with Jason and Vanessa to just assess where they're at and you know, what their desire would be to you know, be a part of this and what their capacity was. And so out of all of those meetings sort of came the idea that it would be really great if we could have an urban campground, but we kind of can't afford that. It's pretty expensive for us as a small community to bear that cost. It doesn't mean that we aren't open to that idea on a regional level, because if we had someone to share those expenses with, or we could get a grant to pay for those expenses, then that would be great. And ideally, it would be an urban campground full of pallet shelters, because those are great. The other things that we have in existence is that, you know, we have a great volunteer shelter network. So while a lot of volunteers have not been able to help because of COVID, the emergency cold weather shelter volunteers are still really willing to serve in that capacity. Our failing is that we don't have locations to put people in because, you know, Aura is using Calvin Hall, which has been used for a long time. All the other churches are pretty small. They don't have enough space to accommodate the social distancing needs. And we don't know how many people, right? We just didn't know how many people we're talking about. Is it 5? Is it 25? Is it 30 or 40? Like, we just don't know. And so, oh, and I talked with Aura too, of course. So anyway, all of those things came together and I sort of was tasked with gathering this information and coming back to the city administrator and saying, okay, this is sort of what the options are. And out of all those options, what we came up with was we could probably afford to buy a few pallet shelters, but we couldn't afford to put them in a campground because then we couldn't afford to pay somebody to run the campground. Or alternatively, we could pay somebody to run a campground, but not through the whole winter because we just don't have that much money. We could potentially rent a facility, you know, on the nights when the inclement weather happens, but then it's trying to find that facility. Traditionally, we've used the library for free, but that's not available right now. And sometimes we can rent the Grange, and that is sometimes available. And the other issue is the short notice of the emergency cold weather shelter. So it's just really hard to gather all the pieces together and get it going, you know, that day or later, you know, in the evening when the weather is turning bad. It just takes a long time. And so one of the ideas that we had out of this was, what if we just bought a few pallet shelters, like 3? Well, really, we started with 10. But that was a lot. And then what if we utilize the overnight parking program in churches and we put the pallet shelters in the parking spots that the cars would be in instead? Because then the pallet shelters, which have heat and electricity, could be plugged into the churches. And then they would be their own little, you know, COVID safe, lockable shelters that keep you out of the weather and keep you warm. And they're still at churches. And all these churches already have a whole program in place, right? Like, they already have porta potties there. They've already gone through an administrative process to allow them to have people camping in their parking lot overnight. Obviously, they're willing to host people in that way and have people there. And then they have a registration system set up through Aura for people to go. And they generally have already identified priority populations for those spaces. And what was the final thing? They have power. They have, oh, and they already have agreements in place for the participants who are staying there. So in some ways we were thinking, well, what we could do is we could shift all the parkers into the park parking spots and we could expand on that. And then we could ask the churches to host these because they have electricity. And that might be a really easy, inexpensive way for us to address this concern. And then for instead of doing an inclement weather shelter, it really would be longer, right? Like you would get to stay here for longer, but hopefully it would be more transitional than the winter shelter program. So people wouldn't be staying for a long, long time. So the next piece was to do some outreach to the churches who were involved in the overnight parking program to gauge their interest in hosting a pallet shelter rather than a parker. And we really only heard back from the Unitarian Church, who was very interested in this model and actually hadn't been doing a parking program for a while, just didn't have any parkers, but would be very interested. So we identified that we could find places for three of these, and we were given the go-ahead to move forward with this as a pilot project to see how all of this will work. So we will be purchasing three pallet shelters, and we will be placing them in parking spots at the Unitarian Church. They will be plugged into the church, and we will help augment the costs of the church for heating and power, because obviously with the cars, they were not paying for those expenses before. The church will provide the porta potty, or will vet the people. And then we're currently working with the emergency cold weather shelter volunteers to set up a system where they can come by in the evening and just do sort of check-ins with the participants and then come by in the morning. So in some ways, it's also safer for them. They're not spending the night, you know, in a congregate room with the different people. The drawbacks are that we know that we're not going to be able to address all of the cold weather inclement shelter needs of the community. We did call an emergency cold weather shelter, not last week, but the week before, for Sunday and Monday night when it got down to 22 degrees, I believe. And we had 5 people and 9 people. So it is early in the season, and there are some other things that I think are mitigating the number of people who would utilize a shelter. I believe that the expo was still open, and I think some people from the Greenway were still there. And so these shelters can accommodate up to 4 people per shelter, which is not at all what we want, because that's not social distancing. That's far too many people, unless they're in one household. And we are thinking more 2 people and hoping that they might be in a household together so that they're still, socially distanced in the sense that they're just one household. So let's see, did I leave anything out? I don't know if you guys all clicked on the link in the memo to look at the pallet shelters. They fit in a parking spot. They're 7.5 by 8.5. They have heater, electricity, a locking door, windows, and bunks where you can buy up to 4, but we're actually just going to buy 2 bunks with beds with mattresses. And is that everything about them? They're easy to clean and sanitize, so when they turn over, we will have them cleaned professionally.
We got a roll, so I'll open it up to questions. Jackie, and then Heidi. Echo quickly, guys.
Okay, so I think it sounds great. I'm all for it. My concern, of course, is when we have really cold weather and snow and everything else, and we've had these cold weather shelters, we've had up to 15, up to 18 people, and this is not going to meet that need. So my question is there some consideration for some kind of warming center that at least people could get out of the snow and even sit at a table with their dog and their pack, but be out of the weather?
You know, I think we're still exploring some other options. I mean, I'm sure that we will still help community volunteers set up some sort of warming shelter. Like I said, we did call a shelter on the last Sunday. We saw the weather forecast and we began that process on Wednesday. And by Sunday or Saturday night at 9 o'clock, we had finally secured a location. So really the only big barrier is the location, and it's just so difficult to find them. And so that really is the stumbling block that we're trying to get around. We have volunteers, we have PPE. I put out a call for PPE and I have like 1,500 masks and, 7 gallons of hand sanitizer and boxes of gloves. So it was amazing.
Okay. Heidi? So Heidi, go ahead.
I didn't hear the cost per unit. And I just want to say, having done that particular job for 10 years, I'm really grateful that you've taken it on, and my sympathies go out to you. And after COVID is over, I'll jump back in, but I just can't right now.
Well, I think the hard part about, doing this work is just that COVID piece. Right? I mean, it's all the pieces. I'm not saying that it's easy when it's not COVID, but that so many places that were on the table are not on the table anymore. So that is definitely more of a challenge. The other piece is that traditionally, I am not supposed to be doing this role. We have farmed it out to other people, like Southern Oregon Jobs with Justice, and they're just not available right now, and there just isn't anyone else to do it. So the cost per unit is $4,900, but does not include the electrical and the bedding. All told, for all three of them, shipped here, put together, because they put them together for you, and then you can move them with a forklift later, will be $25,000. And then Echo had a question.
Where's that coming from?
It will be coming from, so I am excited about this, our old CDBG money that I have to use up. So I checked in with HUD and I said, the answer is probably no, but it turns out everyone's asking this question because, by the way, this is not my idea. I mean, it is my idea to put them in the parking lot of churches, but everyone across the state is doing this. And they're all, I was like, okay, HUD, what money are people using to pay for these things? I mean, some people are buying like 25 of them. How are they paying for this? So HUD did finally make a ruling and say, well, it's a public facility. So we get to use capital.
Echo and then Tom, go ahead.
Okay, so I was just looking online at the pallet.com website. So we're getting the 64 square foot model, not their 100 square foot model.
Yes.
Correct? Yep. And I was just, I think you answered my other questions. I was just curious about that. And I noticed that this got piloted up in Tacoma and Seattle fairly recently as well.
Yeah, and all over. And Rogue Retreat has them here too.
Okay cool. Anyway,
Tom, go ahead.
Unmute.
Hit the mute button.
We can't hear you, Tom.
Great. Thank you. I'm seeing the Rogue Retreat models, and they're very nice, and they go up in an hour. It's interesting. But my question is, as I understand it, the church parking program, you had to leave by a certain time in the morning. And would that apply with this projected program, that you couldn't stay there all day, right?
Well, that's a good question, and we will have to work that out with the church. I mean, I think people could, in fact, stay there all day. The thing that works out with the church right now is that because of COVID, they're not holding services, so they don't need their parking lot.
Yeah.
Which is the part where people needed to leave so they could park there. It does beg the question of where will we move these, or if we have to move these once church starts up again. For now they won't have to move. But I think, you know, the agreement that's in place now, what we've talked about with the church is that, you know, we're probably going to have to adapt it because it's not your car. It's something that belongs to us. And mm-hmm. so it may have some different regulations. Like you said, they don't have to leave. That's in the agreement. But what we liked about this was that the infrastructure of a program is already in place. We're just sort of substituting one thing for another. So hopefully it will be a really smooth, easy thing. I mean, like you said, these things they come and they're put together in an hour, and then we have a safe, warm shelter, and we have a registration process. We have a host. We have people who can, you know, check in on people. We have a bathroom already, and we have an agreement in place. And so I think it'll obviously need some tweaking, but I think that can come down the road.
So hopefully, we'll have church services in person in another few months. And some churches are still doing that. But That's the other issue, is during the church service on Sunday or wherever, you're going to have people in the parking lot, and there are a lot of congregations, I think, that would be wanting to be not so intimately involved. But this is a program that would be fairly short term. If you thought about what you'd do with the shelters after they have to be moved every week or taken down.
Well, what we're hoping is that the Unitarian Church is sort of committed at this point to have them host them through the winter. Since they really, it really is a readily implementable cold weather shelter thing that we're looking at. Mm-hmm. And then when we do have to move them, they can be moved with a forklift and a truck, which the city has. And we can take them apart, but I think, we may want to leave them together. So, there are some options available. We could move them to another host site if we found another willing host site. One thing that I have discussed is essentially, allowing them to be used for free at another organization, a shelter organization. So they could go to Rogue Retreat in Medford, which, sounds bad because then we're sort of losing that capacity. But, we would want them to be used, when we're not using them. Or if Aura had a space and they wanted to host them. So we could look at other options like that, or even Southern Oregon Jobs with Justice. So, we would be open to that. CDBG has a requirement, a use requirement, which is 5 years, or we would have to pay back a portion of that funding. It's not that much funding, but still, we would just want to make sure that wherever they go, that they continue to be used for an eligible population for that time period.
Yeah, and they also would be optimal, from my point of view, for a single person or a couple, not a number of people.
Right. The four people that they quote is really like emergency shelter. Like if you had a disaster and you needed to just get people in a shelter right away, that would be a way to do it. It's very small, obviously, to have that many people. But our thought was, if the priority list is already established and it's, families with children, single women, seniors, peoples with disabilities, if there was a family with children, like we would want them all to be able to be together if we could, manage that.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We've got about 20 minutes more of meeting. If there aren't any other questions, we'll go to the December retreat meeting agenda. And that's going to be really important for us. That's where we set our goals. So Linda, do you have a beginning place that we can discuss about what that agenda would look like?
Well, usually our agenda includes a speaker on a topic of interest and then the goal setting discussion. What I don't have at this point is a speaker, but as Pam mentioned, in talking with her about the manufactured home park thing, she suggested Chelsea Cato, who works for Oregon Housing and Community Services, and Chelsea and I spoke and we had a great conversation. And she used to manage or run, she used to be the executive director of CASA, the funding mechanism for cooperative manufactured home parks. And she also said she was willing to make an introduction and see if that the new executive director would be willing to come and speak with you at your retreat. But before we went down that road, I kind of wanted to gauge your interest in having those people as a speaker. But, Echo's question to Pam Marsh made me think of something else. I went to the Medford Homeless Implementation Plan meeting, or the CAHOOTS meeting, actually, it was both. And I ran into the woman from NAMI there. And we started talking again about last retreat, when NAMI came and spoke and talked about wanting to work together to do some mental health trainings throughout the year. Of course, that was before COVID. But then this puts me in mind of, is there some sort of partnership with NAMI that the commission could do to offer some sort of a Zoom training or mental health awareness to maybe talk about how to deal with, you know, this sort of grief that people are dealing with the loss of these manufactured home parks. And I also want to echo that I have heard a lot of disappointment from the people who are in the park that are outside of Ashland, even though, you know, they are not in the city of Ashland. I think many of them consider themselves as being residents of Ashland and have been very sad and disappointed that the city has not done more. I mean, I did explain to the people that I spoke with that I don't know what the city could do. We can't use our money in the county. You can't get building permits from us. I mean, all of those pieces are sort of missing. And so I did wonder, what would that support look like, and how could we make them feel more included? So anyway, those are just some thoughts that I was having based on the things we've talked about tonight. So what is your will? What are you guys feeling like you would like to hear about at your retreat? Or who do you think would be a good guest speaker or provide more information?
You know, I had a question. Echo, tell me if I'm right or not. I think last time we were all together, you had mentioned Misty and having people who had been affected by the fire, Alameda fire, speak and about their experience. Did you mention that?
Yeah, I may have. Yeah. There was somebody that I had hoped might be a good candidate for joining this commission, but as it turns out, he's an SOU employee, but as it turns out, he actually intends to move back to Phoenix sooner, he hopes, rather than later. But he's an example of somebody I was thinking about having, for example, my friend Shauna, who's another SOU alum from way back in the day. So she actually wrote that Facebook post that Pam just read. And she's currently living in Medford, so not in Ashland. And she's written really powerfully about the loss of community. And then Misty's doing this really amazing grassroots community organizing work. And I wish I knew her more personally than I do, because she seems to be really a bulldog. She seems to be really tenacious. And I really am just so pleased to have connected with her. So now those are not people living in Ashland, but certainly they're talking about the issues that we're dealing with.
So I should clarify that you do not need to live in the city of Ashland to be a member of this commission.
Really?
Mm-hmm. The only commissions you need to be a resident to be a part of are the Planning Commission and the City Council.
No kidding. I learn something new every day.
Well, I'd like to throw, and I'll get to you next, Heidi, but I just wanted to put in, my thoughts are a little less on the immediacy of the fire and COVID and more on how we're developing our housing programs for the coming year. And the one that comes to mind, I mean, I'm not even in favor of this, but is someone from the Housing Authority, which is building 60 units, or my second could be Columbia Care, that's building the units behind that. Then there's also Umpqua, but those are places where we're looking for the year, how are we addressing our affordable housing strategies, and then we could get into barriers, and it's a little bit less what is happening immediately right now that we could address. That's just my vote. And I think somebody else was second. Was it Heidi and then Jackie? Heidi and then Jackie.
I agree with you, Rich. My thought is to focus more on how we can implement affordable housing in Ashland, and it's even more crucial now than ever. And the emotional fallout from the fires is real, but I don't feel that we would really be furthered by doing a training on responding to those emotional needs, because that's sort of not the direction we're supposed to go in. In my opinion, I mean, I think it's fine to do it. That just doesn't feel as urgent to me as the need to figure out lots of different types of housing here in Ashland and how we can brainstorm together to try to figure out mobile home parks, tiny houses. I don't know. And that's part of what I look forward to in the goal setting meeting, is that we all come together and sort of brainstorm ideas of how we can move forward as a community. And so that I don't have any great ideas about speakers, but to me, it's just really helpful for all of us to talk, to have time, uninterrupted time to really just brainstorm.
So Jackie.
So I completely agree with Heidi and with Rich. When I was watching Tuesday's business meeting with the council and listening to everyone, I mean, everyone wants us to find ways to provide more affordable housing. And so one of the things that I would like to hear, I love the idea of Umpqua, Columbia Care, different people who are in the process of trying to get in this affordable housing and hear from them the barriers that they have been facing with Ashland. And then is there something we can learn so that we can make it better and attract these corporations and organizations? I would love to hear Umpqua. I was very interested in this concept of the land trust. So anything like that would educate us as a commission to be able to move forward. And I think we're going to have good personal relationships. I was talking to Linda Rapon today with our council members. I mean, we have Gina, you know, each of us knows different people now on the council and the mayor. I think this is going to be an exciting time for us to really motivate, not just us, but motivate the council, you know, to be moving forward with these different organizations. So thank you. I love that idea of those groups coming in.
Tom.
I don't mean this as criticism of Ashland or the city of Ashland, but as a board member of Rogue Retreat, I'm overwhelmed at every time I go to a meeting, there's a new request from Medford or Grants Pass to do this, and so much support and so few barriers that I really am hopeful that we can do more. And back to, and I know Gina has been pushing the Hardesty property more than most people. I think that's a wonderful example of space we could develop for temporary housing. And so with Gina on the council and a whole new system, I think maybe we can move forward next year and use the retreat as a planning or a staging area for what we can get done.
And Tom, I would just add, like, I've, you know, met with Chad and I know fairly well. And, you know, we've talked often about trying to do something here. And I will tell you right now that the barrier is money. The city just, we don't have that much money. And it's harder for us than it is for a bigger jurisdiction like Medford or or grants pass. And so, I mean, I'm just telling you all that that is the barrier for us to do something with Rogue Retreat, is if we had the funding, we could do it. And, you know, I'm currently exploring grant opportunities to see if we can get some money to help pay for it. And we're currying partnerships and coordination because, I mean, as it is, we just can't do it with the money we have and we need some help. So we may get it. We may not. Oh, and I wanted to say, I can also reach out to NeighborWorks Umpqua to ask them if they would want to present. And the thing I think would be good about NeighborWorks Umpqua is that they do such a broad range of things. So they do the land trust model, but they also build multifamily affordable housing. They build single family affordable housing, and then they can do manufactured home parks. And a little known fact, they're also an advocacy, community advocates group. So they have a lot of different pieces. Oh, and they can do ground financing.
Can I ask, is our housing trust fund money in jeopardy with the marijuana tax? I think I imagine that's going to be diverted to drug and alcohol treatment.
I can answer that. We tax locally. It's the state tax that is going to go back into Measure 110. I'm really on to the 110 thing. I had just a quick suggestion to see if we. I don't see anything wrong with having three or even four people within a Zoom situation where they're giving us an overview and some, you know, answering our questions around what are the opportunities for the coming year that we could do. I mean, they don't have to stay for the whole thing and they don't have to come anywhere. They just would be there to give us their wisdom. And then you could have Umpqua and Columbia. You could have a variety of those, not too many, but some to do that. Well, what do you think about that?
Do you want me to ask both Umpqua and Columbia Care? Because the thing about Columbia Care is that they do a different type of housing. I mean, they do multifamily rental, but they also have, to some extent, like a specific target population. So I kind of feel it would be good to know what they see are barriers, but I kind of have to say if they build one complex, I don't foresee them building another one here anytime soon. I mean, not that they might, you know, I mean, I'm sure that they could, but I'm not sure.
I don't know that they're going to build it, but I think they are the experts in funding projects in the state and could share a little bit about what their priorities look like. Umpqua could be part of that. And who's the other one?
The
Housing Authority.
Reach out to them too.
What?
I can reach out to them as well. How about I'll reach out to all three and see who's available.
How do people feel about that? Nod your head. Is that okay? So I would just say that there's an opportunity to, we could spend the first hour listening to folks and questioning them and getting a kind of a landscape of what's out there. And then they can go home and we could, I mean, they're already home, but we could then use that in developing our outline for the next year.
So we also have to decide when we want to do this, what time.
Correct.
So I thought it would be easier to decide on a time when we were all at the meeting. And then, so if we have a guest speaker for an hour and then maybe another hour and a half for discussion and goal setting, or do you want, I mean, normally we would do 3 hours, but then there's food in between. So it's totally up to you guys to think about the time and how long. So just let me. No.
So we're set for the 10th. So my time is open, but everybody else has got things. I like at least 2.5 and maybe do a break in there and then eat a snack and go to the bathroom and then come back. And so you could schedule a whole 3 hours on my mind, but have a half hour break or something, or 15 minute break where you could go off and do something. We come back and vote on the final priorities.
Could we have it not at night, so it's during the day sometime? I'm fine with the 2.5 hours. I like the break idea, but if it could be somewhere up, not at night.
I think we had decided that we would do it during the daytime. So how, it's a Thursday. How do people's schedules look on Thursday during the day?
Can say 10 to 2
would be good.
What?
10 to 2?
Yeah, that's good.
And take a little lunch break. Oh, Heidi, go ahead.
I can't do 10 to 2. I do grandma school. I have my grandson for school until 2:30. But I could try to reschedule it if that's when everybody else is doing it. But
I can also not make it. I'm free after 2, but not before then.
Right.
So, Linda, what's your schedule?
You, Linda.
Me, Linda? So I'm.
Oh, no, Linda Rapon.
I'm flexible. I can do either of those tonight.
What if we did 2 to 4:30? How would that be for people? That'll work. Will that work for everyone?
Yeah. Everybody raise your hand if you can do that.
Echo.
Okay.
2 to 4:30. Well, that wasn't too hard.
I would suggest that we not put all of the presentations at first and cram our goal setting into the end, because that we want all the time we need to do that. So maybe we could do like a presentation or two, then goal setting, and then another presentation at the end, just so we don't save the part that actually, you know, where we are active to the very end. That makes sense?
It does. I think Linda Reed, can you get us to see if we can really get those groups? And then if anybody wants to, you can kind of involve us in maybe in how we would space them out and what the full agenda would look like. But knowing we've got a time to listen and a time to develop goals. Heidi.
My thought on not doing goal setting in the middle is what I was hoping for was some inspiration from some of the speakers and some direction. So if we heard something from the last speaker and we were like, wow, that would be a great goal for us, but then we've already set our goals. So I would, even though I understand the logic of that, I would do all three presentations if we have three, and then do goal setting after that. And I maybe do a break before goal setting so that we're not so tired. But to me, that's sort of the purpose of having the speakers, is to.
I saw a bunch of nodding. Does that sound like a direction for us? Okay, I think general nodding is good. So
we'll
see if
email.
We can put that together.
I'll email you all with who I hear back from, and so that maybe that will help too, so we know who's coming and how much time we'll have. Uh-oh. You're all frozen on my screen. I don't know if I'm frozen on yours.
Heidi.
Maybe we should invite Rogue Retreat to come and speak and update us on all that they're doing. We could be
inspired. I think we ought to throw it into the mix. Yeah. Yeah. One of them might not be able to do it, and that would be, I think we can pick from those. Linda, are you back? Oh, good.
Yeah,
so you're getting all that.
So you guys were still able to keep going even without me. Mm-hmm. Oh, good.
Yeah.
I was afraid I'd kick you all out at the same time.
Gina, did you want to talk?
Oh, I just right on, Tom. I'm so proud of the progress and what's going on. And thank you for your vote of confidence, because I know money is always an issue, but one thing I admire about Chad, he just keeps it moving. Money is always an issue, but we keep it moving. And that is my vision. So I thank you for that update. And then Linda, I wanted to tell you, Linda Rapon, when you ask about the insurance for manufactured homes, I spoke to two insurances, State Farm and another one, and they are insuring manufactured homes. So nothing is going to skip a beat with the fire. And I'm great. I think it's good to invite Chad to have that in the mix, because yes, we need affordable housing more than ever. And yes, we are going to have unhoused residents. So to have it all in the mix, I think is very important. Thanks for pushing that, Heidi.
I have just a real short announcement that I've been really involved in the implementation of Measure 110, which is the one that decriminalizes small amounts of drugs for the state and puts marijuana money into a new program. And some people are wondering about the implementation of that, because it's coming on pretty fast. And so the Interfaith Social Justice Coalition is sponsoring a forum just like this, a Zoom forum with key people who are discussing the implementation locally. And that will be on December 7th at 5:00. And if anybody wants to be invited, you could just maybe send your name to Linda or me, and I can ensure that people get the invitation if you want to do that. But that is really one of the major racial justice and health initiatives, first in the country, and it's going to be implemented here in Southern Oregon. And so how that happens is the subject. Chris, did you want to give us an update about that? I found that really interesting.
Yeah, I do. I don't like to end meetings on a kind of a, I don't know, sour note, but there is an increase, of course, in cases at SLU, 61 in quarantine. So, you know, we got cases going up, and as we are breaking for the holidays, you know, students will, you know, remain in the house and in the dorms, unless there's a good reason why they need to leave. And then, of course, when they leave, there's a quarantine process where they need to be tested before they're allowed to come back in. So, you know, we're taking additional measures on trying to protect everybody. No new updates on the fire. I haven't learned anything since our last meeting, but as soon as I hear, I will pass that information along.
Yeah, I read your report, and the thing that I was impressed with was how comprehensive SOU is in terms of tracking and connecting and supporting and working with students in this time. It's really, they're not just sitting back and watching it happen. They're really addressing it in a good way. At least it seemed to me in your report.
Right. Absolutely. And I mean, even staff and faculty, I mean, everybody's encouraged to remain home with these, you know, spikes happening as well. So they're even trying to protect, you know, of course, some of their employees. So that's good.
Any other announcements? We're 7 minutes over, but I think, Linda, you want a final note?
I have something really brief. I spoke with the AmeriCorps intern for the conservation department. Her name is Bridget. And she has a program that she's working on that she wanted to bring potentially to this commission in January. So I'll keep you updated on that. And I don't know if you can hear me because you're all frozen again. I hope you heard me.
Unmute, Linda, you're going.
Oh, did you hear me? Did I froze? You didn't hear a word I said? Okay, sorry. So the Conservation Department has an intern, an AmeriCorps intern. Her name is Bridget, and she's working on a project and maybe coming to you at your January meeting to talk about the project that she is proposing and to get some feedback about community engagement and the need for the project in the community. But I'll keep you posted.
Great, wonderful people, wonderful meeting. Thanks all. And we'll gather again in December.
Bye, you guys. Have a good night. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.